that our minds might be prepared, brethren and sisters, for the partaking of the emblems, we shall now receive the word of exhortation from our brother Jim Cowd.
Presiding Banner and my beloved brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, we bring with us the loving and fraternal greetings of your brethren and sisters at the Wilston Ecclesia. We left last evening, brethren and sisters, of the man Jeroboam ascending the throne of Israel. We caught a very brief glimpse of Rehoboam fleeing to Jerusalem and preparing his army to take back his lost empire. We caught a brief glimpse also of Israel electing Jeroboam by common consent to be their king. And we saw the potential of the man whom Yahweh chose virtually to replace David in that nation, because Solomon, David's son, had been a miserable failure and didn't have the safe heart that his father possessed. And this morning we come to consider Jeroboam as the great test of his life comes upon him, and a decision has to be made as to which direction he will go as he guides the ecclesia of God. And he made, of course, the wrong choice, a terrible decision which brought ruin and disaster to the ecclesia of God until it was taken away many hundreds of years later on. Ecclesia life is often tinged with tragedy, isn't it, brethren and sisters? We recognise that as we listen to the affairs of both our own brethren and sisters in this place and far and wide. But there is perhaps no greater tragedy than to see someone like this man of God from Judah, whom we shall consider this morning, fail in the mission that could have turned Jeroboam's apostasy around. There is no greater tragedy than to see a man especially chosen by his God to perform a mission which could have succeeded and apparently did succeed, to end up seeing him fail because of his hypocritical disobedience to the word of Yahweh. And if this story this morning proves nothing else to us, it will prove this: that we are all flesh, that we are all subject to the same problems that the men and women who lived in the days of the kings of Israel and Judah were subject to, but we do need the exhortation that arises from this section of God's word. And we can also learn this lesson: we don't have to fail. It's not inevitable that we will fail. Many did fail in those times, but there were some who didn't. And they didn't fail because they held fast throughout their lives to the word of Yahweh. And that's a phrase that you're going to see recurs repeatedly throughout the 13th chapter of the 1st of Kings. It's one of the vital keys to that chapter. Let us pick up the record in chapter 12 of the 1st of Kings and at verse 25. For here we have Jeroboam building Shechem as his capital. Shechem, we know, means the shoulder, and by extension of that idea, to shoulder a burden. And he came to Shechem to shoulder the burden of responsibility of leading God's ecclesia in those times. It was in Mount Ephraim, the mountain of double fruit, and he could have brought forth double fruit. Yahweh had said to him, "You shall reign over all that your heart could desire. And if you walk in my ways, Jeroboam, I will be with thee, and you will bring forth fruit to me. And I will make with thee a sure covenant, as I made with David." He could have brought forth double fruit if he had shouldered the burden, brethren and sisters. But he went from thence, we read in verse 25, and built Peniel. Now we know that Peniel was across Jordan. It was the place where Jacob had been taught the great lesson of his life, when he had seen that he could no longer rely upon himself. He could no longer rely upon his own schemes, his own ideas to accomplish what Yahweh had in mind for him. He came to learn at Peniel that he had to seek the face of Yahweh, and of course that's what the name means. And he sought the face of Yahweh and he found it. And he learned, brethren and sisters, that it was no good relying upon your own strength. It was in Yahweh's hands to make him a prince with ale, that he might prevail with God. Very interesting, isn't it, that Jeroboam should find himself in Peniel, because it was there that he made a decision which was to guide that nation, God's people, into absolute disaster. It was there that he sat down in verse 26 and said in his heart, notice it's in his heart, the great test had come upon him. Now, he says, the kingdom shall return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of Yahweh at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord. Notice the language. This is what's going on in his heart. Yahweh had said to him, I will make you the Lord, the Adon, the ruler of Israel. Just turn back quickly to chapter 11 and have these words firmly in our minds as we see what was happening in the heart of Jeroboam. In the 35th verse of chapter 11, this was the prophecy of Ahijah. Yahweh says through him, I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and will give it unto thee, Jeroboam, even 10 tribes. And unto his son will I give 1 tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me to put my name there. And I will take thee, I have chosen you, I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and thou shalt be king over Israel. You, Jeroboam, will be their Adon. I have made you their lord, their ruler, and I have chosen you for a reason. And it shall be, verse 38, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and will walk in my ways, and do that which is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, I will be with thee, and will build thee a sure house as I built for David, and I will give Israel unto thee. Now there was the promise, brothers and sisters. All he had to do was to believe it, but he couldn't believe it. And so in that 12th chapter, in verses 26 and 27, Jeroboam became concerned about the prospect of the nation going up to Jerusalem, as they were commanded to do, 3 times in a year. You know the commandment of Deuteronomy 12, verses 5 to 14. Thrice in a year shall all males appear before me in the place where I set my name. Even Jeroboam himself would have to go up 3 times in a year to worship Yahweh. And he sat down and thought to himself, how on earth can I sustain my kingdom and keep this people to myself? How is it possible for my kingdom to be established if 3 times every year, every single male, which means all the soldiers of his army, every single male has to go up to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh, and they're 150 yards away from the palace of King Rehoboam, who hated Jeroboam with a bitter hatred. It was a great test, wasn't it, brothers and sisters? It required enormous faith. It necessitated Jeroboam saying to himself, well, Yahweh's made a promise and he'll keep it, and I'll rely upon that promise, and I will go up there myself and let him establish my kingdom. But we've seen him, haven't we? He was an ambitious man. He had pride, and proud men don't think like that. They thrust themselves not upon Yahweh, but upon the machinations of their own mind. And that's what Jeroboam did. And so he said in his heart, they will turn unto their Lord. He didn't believe Yahweh's promise. And so we read in the 28th verse that he had a plan. Wherefore the king took counsel, that is with himself, and he made 2 calves of gold and said unto them, and look at these words, the very first words that come out of his mouth, find Jeroboam manhandling the principles of the atonement. It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold, thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Where'd he get that idea from? Well, he'd spent 4 years in Egypt, and his eyes were full of the imagery of Egypt. And he came back. And borrowing, of course, from the wilderness wanderings and the record of Exodus 32, which he must have known, like Aaron, he makes not just one golden calf, but two, patterning it after the young bull of Egypt, Apis, which had, of course, in its pattern of worship, all the immorality to which the Egyptians were prone. It is too much for you, O Israel, to go to Jerusalem three times in a year. I will make golden calves, and we will worship them in the place that I choose. Behold, these be thy gods, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Make a note, if you would, if you haven't got one in your margin, to Exodus chapter 20, verses 2 to 4. That, brothers and sisters, is the record of the giving of the 10 words, the 10 commandments. And the very first words that Israel heard from the mouth of their God were these: I am Yahweh thy God, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. In other words, I have worked the atonement on your behalf. I have taken you from the house of sin and death, from the bondage of Egypt. I have brought you across the Red Sea and baptized you. I have brought you into the wilderness unto myself and borne you upon eagle's wings. I am Yahweh that's accomplished that. It's my work of atonement. And here's Jeroboam getting hold of the doctrine of the atonement and manhandling it that he might shape it into something which would suit his own purpose. And isn't it a fact of life, a fact of history, that when people go astray in the truth, it's nearly always that they have either misunderstood or that they have twisted the principles of the atonement. And Jeroboam did that both in doctrine and in practice. Have a look at the practice that flowed from his doctrine. It is too much for you. You know, brothers and sisters, we don't say that to ourselves, do we? Because we know what the truth requires of us. But those who wish to bring about a denigration of the standards of the truth nearly always start by saying, it's too much for you, brethren, to do all the things that others would say you have to do. You don't have to do all that Bible study, and you don't need to go to three Bible schools in a year. That's too much. It's too much for you to come to all the meetings. God doesn't require that. Providing you are sound in your heart, that is all that God wants. The rest is simply too much. Have a look, brothers and sisters, at verse 29. And he set for one of these golden calves in Bethel, the house of God, which was on the border between Israel and Judah, an obvious place to put it. And he put the other in Dan, which of course was way up north on the northern border of Israel. Dan means judgment. Quite appropriate, that, isn't it? And this thing, verse 30, became a sin. It became a sin. Why? For the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. Now that's exactly how the flesh operates, isn't it, brethren and sisters? You say to people, look, it's too much for you to talk about all this sacrifice that the truth allegedly requires. Don't worry about all that. Providing you're doing good works here and there and you just keep yourself going in a direction that is apparently okay, don't worry about all the extra sacrifice that the truth is supposedly placing upon you. You just do the good things that will signify that your heart is sound. Brothers and sisters, what happens? Well, what happens to us is what happened to the men and women of Israel. When guided by Jeroboam, placing one of the golden calves in Bethel and the other in Dan, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that the bulk of Israel who lived around Shechem, in that area around Mount Ephraim, would have gone to the one at Bethel. That was the closest one. The pathways, the highways and the byways that led to that place were well trodden. You would have thought, wouldn't you, that they would frequent Bethel. But no, it became a sin because they went 75 miles northwards over rough and uncharted terrain to go to Dan. And what happens when you write down the things of the atonement? Well, I'll give you an example. When you start bringing about a diminution of the standards of the truth, There's a gradual decline until people will go to judgment rather than towards the house of God. And if you say to them, don't worry, we're going to Bible schools for the study classes, but you know we're having a wonderful week up in Cairns, and we're going to enjoy the sun and the surf and all the good things that that place has got to offer for the flesh. Oh yes, we'll have a few discussions about this or that. You know, brothers and sisters, we would ride bicycles to Cairns to get there, wouldn't we? We would ride bicycles to get there. But they wouldn't come to the meetings. They're just a short distance away. Have you ever seen that happen? I have. And it does happen when we write down the standards of the truth and start saying, it is too much to require of brethren that they do this or do that. And Jeroboam brought about a disaster because he got hold of the atonement and he twisted it. Twisted it. That it might suit people. And then he went a step further in verse 31. He made an house of high places, and he made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. That word lowest there in the Hebrew means an extremity. From the whole range of the people. It wasn't that he got those who were the lowest in terms of status in the nation. It was that he simply threw the priesthood wide open. And anybody could become a priest, as far as he was concerned, providing they had one qualification: total ignorance of the word of God. They couldn't have anything else to be Jeroboam's priest, because what he wanted, of course, was to foster ignorance, that he might bring that people into bondage to his own way. And so he throws the priesthood open and makes of the lowest of the people priests, which were not of the sons of Levi. The result of that, brethren and sisters, which we'll look at this afternoon, God willing, is that there was a mass migration, both of Levites and of many others in the nation of Israel, down to Judah, because there at least there were some good things. And even though Rehoboam was about to go the wrong way himself, there were some good things in Judah. And the migration continued, unabated, until the days of Abijah, and then began again in the times of King Asa. It was brought about because of this policy of Jeroboam to throw the priesthood wide open. And he himself became the high priest of his new system. So in verse 32 we read, Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 8th month. On the 15th day of the month, he took it upon himself to manipulate the feasts of Yahweh. Of course, the 15th day of the 7th month was the commencement of the Feast of Tabernacles. It followed hard on the Day of Atonement, the most important day in Israel's religious year. You see, he separated the principles of the atonement from the fraternal gatherings in the brotherhood. He put a distance between the Day of Atonement and a feast that he devised in his own heart, segregating that which concerned sacrifice from that which concerned fraternity amongst the brethren. So the idea of that, he knew what he was doing. And so he waited until the 8th month, and on the 15th day he instituted this new festival. Now I want you to notice really carefully the language of verses 32 and 33 of this chapter, because we're being told something here which is vital to understand what follows in the 13th chapter. Jeroboam ordained this feast, like the feast that is in Judah, and he offered upon the altar. Now in my Bible I've underlined the words, and he offered upon the altar, because they are repeated three times in two verses. You see, it was Jeroboam who was the high priest of this new system, and he had made other priests like himself who had no right to be priests in the nation, and they had instituted this new festival, and this, brethren and sisters, was the great inaugural day of Jeroboam's new religion. He twisted the atonement, he had a new statement of faith, he had a new priesthood, and he had set this day down as being the day when it would all commence. And on that day, he himself, as the high priest, stood up and offered upon the altar. So did he in Bethel, says verse 32, sacrificing unto the calves. Notice that. It was later on that they were placed in Bethel and in Dan, but on this day, the 15th day of the 8th month, both of the calves were in Bethel, and they were there for the inauguration. And so he sacrificed to the calves that were there in Bethel that day. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. So he offered upon the altar. Notice that? It's telling us that we ought to be able to create in our minds a picture of that day. We ought to be able to see Jeroboam standing there dressed up in his new robes. He'd widely advertised this day throughout the entire nation of Israel, and they came from all parts to be there on this great inaugural day. Everything had to go right, and he had meticulously planned it. He knew what he was doing, and he knew if he could capture the hearts of this people, and if he could win the battle this day, then the rest was plain sailing. And so he has set down this special day. And he offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised, invented, of his own heart, and ordained a feast unto the children of Israel, and he offered upon the altar and burnt incense. Notice the emphasis upon this. There he is, standing up there, making the offering. And as the offering ascends up, not to Yahweh, because of course he wasn't making an offering to Yahweh, but to the calves, who he thought would represent to the people Yahweh their God. But of course he was absolutely wrong. They never took it that way. Even as Israel in the wilderness had not taken it that way when Aaron had made a golden calf to represent Yahweh. And so, brothers and sisters, we can cross out in our Bibles the chapter division between chapters 12 and 13, because really we are intended to read on. And he offered upon the altar and burnt incense, and behold, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of Yahweh unto Bethel. And Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense. See the connection with the last verse of the previous chapter? Here he was, he'd made the offering, and now he was about to offer prayers to burn incense. Would it be accepted? No, it wouldn't be accepted, because there came a divine representative, the man of God from Judah, and he was out of Judah, and he came into Israel. I want you to notice this fact, brothers and sisters. This man of God from Judah is not called a prophet, except on one occasion in this chapter, and that was after his mission had failed. He is called a man of God from Judah for a very special reason, because he came to represent Yahweh and to declare his judgments against Jeroboam's system, and to demonstrate that Yahweh was out of fellowship with Jeroboam. That was his mission. And you see there in verse 1 of chapter 13 that it says that he came by the word of Yahweh. I want you to do an exercise, if you would, if you've got time today, and probably won't have much time today. But please, do an exercise in this chapter, which will help you later on, when you come to read it again. The word of Yahweh is a phrase that is used 9 times in this chapter, and it's in tandem with another phrase that is used twice, the mouth of Yahweh. Just quickly, if you're taking some notes, it's in verse 1, and again in verse 2, at the end of verse 3, in verse 9, in verse 17, in verse 18, again in verse 20, and then again at the end of verse 26, and finally in verse 32. Now when you read the chapter, you will detect 2 places where a different phrase occurs, although in the middle of verse 26, the actual words, the word of Yahweh, occur, although the Hebrew is different. You see, the word of Yahweh of verse 1 is the Hebrew word devar, which simply means a word. It's the common word for word. That is used 9 times in this chapter. The word pay, which means mouth and can be rendered word, occurs in the middle of verse 21. You'll see there, disobey the mouth of Yahweh.
And in the middle of verse 26, where it says there, unto the word of Yahweh, it should actually read, unto the mouth of Yahweh. So 9 times you find the phrase, the word of Yahweh, and twice you find the phrase, the mouth of Yahweh. 9, brethren and sisters, is the biblical number for finality and judgment. And here was the man of God, the divine representative, who came to deliver the divine edict of judgment against Jeroboam's system. 9. 2 is the number of division. He came to tell Jeroboam that Yahweh was out of fellowship with him. I'll show you if that's what he was about in a moment. But when you add 9 and 2 together, you get 11. And 11 is the biblical number of disorganization or failure. And this man of God from Judah never went home. He never got home because he failed in his mission. Very curious that we find in that chapter, just in the way in which the phrases are used and the number of times that they're used, that the mission of this man is set forth very plainly. So let's read verse 2. He cried against the altar in the word of Yahweh. And here is the judgment. It wasn't against Jeroboam specifically, but against the system that he had instituted. So he says, oh, altar, altar, it's the system of the atonement that you've introduced that I'm condemning. Yahweh cannot tolerate the twisting of the basics of the atonement in doctrine or practice. He can only walk with light, and Jeroboam, your system, is absolutely abhorrent to him. O altar, altar, thus saith Yahweh, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David. I chose you to carry on where David left off, Jeroboam. But now a child shall be born to the house of David. No longer will I afflict that house, David's house will afflict you. And so he goes on to say, Josiah would be his name. Yah hath found it. And upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burnt upon thee. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which Yahweh hath spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. You see, the ashes were those ashes of the burnt offerings that were being made by Jeroboam. And the ashes, the mingling of ash with the fat of the sacrifice, was holy. It had to be taken and placed either in a holy place beside the altar, or at times outside the camp, in a place especially chosen for that purpose. And when the ashes were spilled upon the altar, and the altar was rent apart, it both defiled the offering and negated the sacrifice that had been made. And so, brothers and sisters, what we have here is a sign from Yahweh that Jeroboam sacrificed that day to bring about the inauguration of his system, was repudiated by God. Can you imagine the long face on that man as he stood there dressed up in his garments? This new priesthood gathered around him, and they're all standing there with smirks on their faces as they see that they've overwhelmed that nation. And the nation is there being led by sheep away from the things of God. And all of a sudden, as they're about to offer incense, as though they were offering prayers to Yahweh, there bursts upon that scene a man of God out of Judah and cries out against the altar, O altar, altar, thus saith Yahweh, you are going to be rent, the sacrifice negated, the priesthood evicted, and there will arise a man from the house of David who will destroy the remnants of this system. 308 years later, mind you, but he would come. How would you feel if you were Jeroboam? Well, he was not about to let things slip out of his grasp that easily. And so we read in the fourth verse, it came to pass when King Jeroboam, with a long face, heard the saying of the man of God which had cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar. The altar was a symbol of his system. Hand was a symbol of power. He had his hand upon the altar, brethren and sisters. There was the power of Jeroboam's system. And he took his hand off the altar and put it on the man of God and said, lay hold on him. And all of a sudden, his hand withered in paralysis.
you see, brothers and sisters, under the law of Moses, a man with a withered hand or a deformity of body could not take the part of a priest. Leviticus 21, verses 21 to 23. He was disqualified from priesthood, and Yahweh was indicating to Jeroboam that his system and his priesthood were finished. His hand dried up so that he could not draw it in again unto him. And the altar was rent, the ashes were spilt, the sacrifice and the system were negated. We read at the end of verse 5 that it happened according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of Yahweh. There was the divine judgment. And the king then tries to recover the situation. Verse 6, he answered and said to the man of God, "Entreat now the face of Yahweh." Peniel, remember, this is where it all began. It was back in Peniel, the face of Yahweh, that he decided to cast himself upon his own imaginations, his own scheming. He hadn't learnt the lesson that Jacob had learnt in that place. And now, brothers and sisters, he cries out to the man of God, "Entreat the face of Yahweh, thy God." He couldn't say "my God." "And pray for me that my hand may be restored me again." And the man of God besought Yahweh, and the king's hand was restored him again, and he became as it was before. And Jeroboam, having been relieved of the paralysis that had overtaken his arm, his hand, now began to scheme again. And he says to the man of God, who obviously looked very tired because he journeyed that day out of Judah, non-stop, perhaps from 20 or 30 miles away, he had arrived right on the dot when incense was about to be offered. He was obviously very tired. Jeroboam recognized that, and he said to him in verse 7, "Come home with me and refresh thyself, and I will give thee a gift." He's going to try and buy him off. Bribery. "Come home with me." Brothers and sisters, that actually should be rendered, "Come in with me to the house." And he meant the house of the high places that was referred to in verse 31 of chapter 12, remember? He made an house of high places. And so there in Bethel he built a new ecclesial hall, which was to replace the temple in Jerusalem. "Come in with me into my new ecclesial hall, and I will give thee a reward." He would have quite gladly cut his throat. But he was going to try and bribe this man. Look at the reply. And the man of God in verse 8 said, "If thou will give me half your ecclesia," give me half the ecclesia and the hall, "I will not go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place." And that, brothers and sisters, meant that he would have no fellowship with him. To eat bread and to drink water was, of course, a sign of fellowship. And Yahweh had commanded him to have no fellowship with Jeroboam or with his ecclesia. Because, you see, Yahweh cannot walk with darkness. And they had twisted the atonement in doctrine and in practice. And so we find that he repudiates the request of Jeroboam and tells him why in verse 9. "For so it was charged me by the word of Yahweh." He was sticking to that, saying, "Eat no bread, nor drink water, nor turn again by the same way that thou camest." Now here we meet another very interesting turn in this chapter. And this is the second exercise for you. What I've done in my Bible is to use a colouring in pencil or a highlighting pen, and it's very helpful. The word "way" in this chapter is used 12 times. 11 times in the actual story of the man of God in Bethel, and once at the end of the chapter in a very interesting way. If you go through your Bible in this chapter and mark in the words "way," you will find, brothers and sisters, that it will add something to the reading of it. I'll show you what it will add. You see, that day, the whole of Israel had journeyed in Jeroboam's way. They'd come from Dan, they'd come from the borders over at Peniel, they'd come right over from the Shephelah on the sea coast of the Mediterranean, and they'd made their way to Bethel. And that is where Jeroboam had established this new system. And there would come one man out of Judah to deliver the divine edict of judgment. And he was commanded not to turn again by the same way that he had come. You see, if you had been in Judah that day, you would have known what was going on. The 15th day of the 8th month had been widely advertised. You would have known. But anybody going from Judah towards Bethel on that day was going to Jeroboam's inauguration festival. The great meeting that he had devised in his own heart to begin this new system of worship. And the men of Judah would have seen the man of God walking towards Bethel. And they would have thought to themselves, he's going up to that festival. We shouldn't be going there. And they were right. And so Yahweh said, you must not return by the same way. In other words, brothers and sisters, he was not to give the appearance that he was going up to be a part of that festival. Going up and then going home, like you and I go to meetings and go back again. He was to go out another way. If you're going to go in, you stay in. If you're going to get out, you stay out. That was the message that he gave, by going out another way. And so the men of Judah who saw the man of God come out from Bethel would have thought to themselves, we didn't see him go in. He must be getting away from that. Get the idea of that? So we read in verse 10, he went another way. And the words are carefully chosen. And he returned not by the way that he came, because that was Jeroboam's way. Yahweh was out of fellowship with Jeroboam, and for the time being with his ecclesia, because they were not walking in his way. And brethren and sisters, the man of God from Judah was there to represent his God. That's why he's called a man of God. He had a mission, a responsibility, and up to this point he had kept it. And he had stood firm by the word of Yahweh. But there was a problem. He was to be tested too. Verse 11. Now there dwelt an old prophet in Bethel, and his sons came and told him all the works that the man of God had done that day in Bethel, the words which he had spoken unto the king. Then they told also their father. Now you analyse that verse. There was an old prophet in Bethel. He was one of the remnants of Samuel's schools of the prophets. Samuel had a school in Bethel. He was a man who had been brought up on the pioneers of the schools of the prophets. He was a man who was still called a prophet, which means he had the basics of the truth firmly entrenched. And that's why, brothers and sisters, he was not there at the day, on that day of the inauguration of Jeroboam's new system. He was absent from it. He had no sympathy for what Jeroboam was doing. He probably detested it. But his sons were there. What were they doing at Jeroboam's inauguration festivities? Happens, doesn't it? There were many others in Israel who got out. And they flooded into Judah. But not the old prophet. He decided to stop behind. And when he heard the story of the man of God from Judah, he thought, brethren and sisters, that he had something very much in common with that man. And so he desired to talk with him. Verse 12. Their father said unto them, what way went he? Wasn't in Jeroboam's way. He was going back to Judah. For his sons had seen what way the man of God went, which came from Judah. And he said unto his sons, saddle me the ass. The ass was a symbol of Israel. So they saddled him the ass, and he rode thereon
towards Judah, and that was his responsibility. He should have been riding the ass of Israel away from apostasy and towards Judah. He should have been in the vanguard of those who said to Jeroboam, "You can have your system, but we will go up to the place that Yahweh has put his name in 3 times in a year, according to the law. We don't want your system, Jeroboam. We want that which Yahweh has provided in Jerusalem." He ought to have been guiding the ass of Israel towards Judah, I should say, towards Jerusalem. What was he doing, brothers and sisters? He was content to sit back in Bethel and watch it happen. And yet he had enormous sympathies for the man of God from Judah. He felt isolated in that nation. He was a genuine man. And so we read in verse 14, "But he went after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak." Sitting under an oak. Symbol of strength. And yet he was sitting under it. I don't know the Christadelphian who is strong when they are spiritually sitting in the truth. All right, he might have been tired and weary. But brethren and sisters, he ought to have been walking in the way towards Judah. But he was sitting. And it was in that posture that the old prophet of Bethel found him. And says to him at the end of verse 14, "Art thou the man of God that camest from Judah?" And he said, "I am." Then he said unto him, "Come home with me and eat bread. You can fellowship with me. I don't have any sympathies for Jeroboam at all." And he said, "I may not return with thee, nor go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water with thee in this place, for it was said to me by the word of Yahweh," still standing by that, "thou shalt eat no bread nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou camest." He had his mission down to a T. He knew exactly what he was about. But, brethren and sisters, the pressure was then placed upon him in verse 18. And he said unto him, "I am a prophet also as thou. And an angel spake unto me by the word of Yahweh, saying, bring him back with thee into thine house, that he may eat bread and drink water." But he lied unto him. "An angel spake unto me by the word of Yahweh." He had a different interpretation, brethren and sisters, of what was in the word of Yahweh. "If any man preach anything unto you, even an angel," if we or an angel preach anything unto you, "than that which we the apostles have preached unto you, let him be disfellowshipped." That was Paul's warning to the Galatians. They were words that could have well been spoken into the ears of the man of God from Judah. He needed it. Because you see, he was sucked in by the lie of the old prophet. He was a sincere brother. He was genuine. He was a man who had a basis in the things of old. He had evidently had no sympathy at all for what Jeroboam was doing. What was wrong with going back with him? So he went back, verse 19, "and did eat bread in his house and drank water." Can you get the scene? Where were they? Where did he go back to? Well, we're told that he went back to Bethel. That's where the old prophet dwelt. He went right back to Bethel, which he had left behind, having said to Jeroboam, "I must not remain in this place, nor fellowship with you here." He went back and sat in the house of the old prophet. And in verse 20, "it came to pass as they sat at the table that the word of Yahweh came unto the prophet that brought him back. And he cried unto the man of God." You see, really what is happening now, brothers and sisters, is that the man of God has taken the place of Jeroboam, and the old prophet has virtually taken the place of the man of God. And whereas the man of God had cried out against the altar of Jeroboam, now it's the old prophet who's crying out against the man of God. And that's what happens when there is disobedience and hypocrisy. There is a total destruction of Yahweh's intentions. And so he cried out to the man of God that came from Judah, saying, "Thus saith Yahweh, for as much as thou hast disobeyed," the word means to rebel, of course, "because you've rebelled against the mouth of Yahweh and hast not kept the commandment which Yahweh thy God commanded thee, but has come back and eaten bread and drunk water in the place," and you might emphasize that by saying, "in the very place that you were commanded not to do so, thy carcass shall not come to the sepulchre of thy fathers." You will lose your identification with your inheritance. They won't even take your body back to your inheritance. 9 plus 2 is 11. Failure. What a shocking thing it was. I wonder whether we can imagine that scene with the old prophet sitting one side of the table and the man of God the other, and there they are talking about the old days, talking about the times when things were much better in the brotherhood than they were today, talking about what ought to be done and could be done. And all of a sudden the spirit of Yahweh comes upon the old prophet, and he stands up, and with a steely look on his face, he points the accusing finger at the man of God. Can you imagine the look upon the face of that man? Brothers and sisters, there is a lesson for us in that, is there not? And it came to pass in verse 23, after he had eaten bread, and after he had drunk, that he saddled for him the ass. And the man of God was going to ride the ass now. But the man of God had virtually become Jeroboam by disobedience. And so verse 24 we read, when he was gone, a lion met him by the way. Notice that. A lion met him by the way and slew him. And his carcass was cast in the way. And the ass stood by it, and the lion also stood by the carcass, but the lion didn't attack the ass. The ass, of course, as I've said, is a symbol of Israel. And the man of God from Judah had virtually become Jeroboam, and Yahweh was saying, in this symbology, yes, I'm going to remove Jeroboam and his system, I will destroy his house, but I'll leave Israel for the time being. And in Hosea chapter 5 and verse 14, which is a very handy reference to have alongside that verse, in Hosea 5 and verse 14, Yahweh says to the prophet, "I will be a lion unto the house of Ephraim." I, Yahweh, will be a lion to the house of Ephraim, and I will tear and depart. The time had not come for Yahweh to send the Assyrian lion to rend the ass as well as its rider. And so we here have in this 24th verse a graphic symbol, a portrayal of what Yahweh intended to do. Destroy Jeroboam and his system, but leave Israel, that it might be guided in the way. But the man of God from Judah, because of his hypocrisy and disobedience, had become, brothers and sisters, Jeroboam himself. Yahweh is no respecter of persons. He had not stood by the word of Yahweh, and so he ended up in exactly the same position as the king whom he came to condemn. I want to show you something as we conclude this morning. We haven't got time to go into the details of this very sad burial of the man of God from Judah. One of the most poignant scenes in the whole of the scriptures, as the old prophet sends out to take him back, he brings his body back and lays it in his own grave and insists that his son should bury him in the same place, that he might share with the man of God from Judah the word of Yahweh, which he knew would come to pass, despite the fact that the man of God had failed. He knew that the word of Yahweh would always come to pass. It's in verse 33 that we have the final lesson in this morning's exhortation, and it's a very important one. For there we read, "After this thing That is, after the demise of the man of God from Judah in these tragic circumstances, which Jeroboam must have known about, because you see, he went back to Bethel, and when he left there on the ass, they brought his body back from the way and buried him in Bethel. Jeroboam must have seen or heard about the funeral procession that went from the house of the old prophet. He must have seen them bearing the body of the man of God from Judah to bury it on a hillside in Bethel. And therefore, brothers and sisters, he had reason to turn back from the reformation that had apparently been decided upon that day. Have a look at verse 33 with me. After this thing, Jeroboam returned not from his evil way. Notice the language. From his evil way. Why should he? Brethren and sisters. Why should he? When God's own representative was now walking in Jeroboam's evil way. Had the man of God from Judah gone out by another way, Jeroboam might have reformed himself, because it says, but made again. Notice the margin. He returned and made. Doesn't that suggest that he might have altered his policy? Doesn't it suggest that the events of that day, the edict, the withered hand, the rebuttal, the declaration of no fellowship, doesn't that suggest that those events might have made Jeroboam rethink? Might he not have sacked the priests and said, look, this is a total failure, we'll give it up? Might he not have considered returning to the pure worship of Yahweh? I believe that he was going to do that until they brought back the body of the man of God from Judah. And then he wrung his hands in glee. You beauty. You know, the lesson of that is that we cannot afford to stand up and to set ourselves forward as the upholders of the fundamentals of the truth in the spirit of the pioneers, unless we are prepared to live the principles of the atonement which we say we maintain. For if we don't live in accordance with what we say, we give cause to those like Jeroboam who are looking for a justification to proceed in their way. What a verse that is. After this thing, Jeroboam returned not from his evil way, but returned and made of the whole range of the people priests of the high places. Whosoever would, the ignorant, the foolish, the rich, and those who could afford to pay to have control over their brethren, he consecrated him, and he became one of the priests of the high places. And Jeroboam's system, though it had got off to a bad start, was now well and truly on the way because of the failure of the man of God from Judah. We have come, brethren and sisters, to remember a man who above all others was a man of God from Judah. And in his life, he held fast to the word of Yahweh until ultimately it brought him to death in total sacrifice to uphold the principles of the atonement. In him there was no hypocrisy. In him there was no disobedience to the word of Yahweh. In him there was that safety of heart which had been in David, which could have been in Jeroboam, and which was initially in the man of God from Judah, until finally he was deceived by his own brethren. Let us, brethren and sisters, take on board the lessons of the tragic end of the man of God from Judah, and walk in the way of Yahweh by the power of his word.